the truth, fact, and effect. Now, the only answer that is made to that that I can see is that there had been that verbal statement made in court and a motion to that effect that they made in court. It's difficult for me to see that anybody doesn't perceive the vast difference between those two circumstances. What is stated in court in a motion upon which no proof has been adduced is not a fact. Nobody can be misled by that. For it to be stated that Mr. Haynes is contending so and so, and Mr. Haynes is contending this, and Mr. Haynes is contending that in his motion filed in the court, nobody can question that. But when it is stated that it is true, extrajudicial, and as an assertion of truth which is unsupported by any verification, which is not supported by any proof whatever, that is in violation of the order, and it is in violation of the specific order, because there is in the order specific that no one shall make extrajudicial statements about the treatment of the prisoner. It's as specific as it can be. And the fact that there may be a motion pending in which Mr. Haynes may intend and may in fact at some future time prove the truth of those assertions does not justify making the extrajudicial statement that it is true. I hope that that difference will in time become clear. Now, Mr. Livingston, I must say that the way this matter has developed, there is a very weak case against Mr. Livingston's client, and he has gone very far towards going forward with carrying the risk of non-persuasion as well as the burden of going forward. Now, here is the proof of reference as to him. He has gotten on the stand and he has testified under oath that of the five statements that appear in this article of September 12th, that only one of them resulted from his statements. Now, that one is a perfectly inoffensive and proper statement that nobody should be afraid to talk to him, and it was proper for him to talk to anybody. He denies categorically that he made these other statements that appear under Mr. Edmondson's byline. Mr. Edmondson has sat in court. He has heard the testimony under oath. He has not taken the stand tonight, which is a circumstantial support to the truth and to the trustworthiness. This is what Mr. Renfro Hayes says. So I can't say if Your Honor please that when the quantum of the proof is considered, that there is any strong or pervasive proof that he made those statements which Mr. Edmondson attributes to him, in which Mr. Edmondson has not seen fit to give us the benefit of his testimony that Mr. Hayes did make those statements.
Excuse me for interrupting you.
Yes, please.
I was interested in this last statement of Mr. Edmondson's article. I don't for a moment think Sheriff Bill Morris is trying to drive this guy out of his mind, but it's the effect of this type of surveillance that counts.
I got his testimony. He says that he did not say that last sentence. That what he did say was, in effect, that Bill Morris was a nice guy, and he didn't believe that Bill Morris was willing to do anything to hurt anybody. That was the substance of his testimony, as I recall it. Of course, Your Honor will study the record, or it is available. But that's my recollection of it. Now, just to put an end to this titillation that seems to be disturbing Mr. Livingston about my prejudice in this matter and the black arts and control by which I manage this committee here, You were supposed to be as the chairman. I will let Mr. Livingston know, just for his edification, as to how I happened to be here. This committee met on Friday. Everybody was present but me, and I went fishing. And so, not being there to defend myself, they concluded that I was the one to do the actions in this office. I assure you that I have no prejudice of any sort, and if I did, if my heart was black and malign as it could be, it would have no relevancy whatever, as long as your honor is not prejudiced. And I don't believe that Mr. Livingston, in his wildest moments, will have the temerity to assert that. Now, I've come to the remark made by Mr. Clay, which in my mind is the only argument that raises any substantial legal questions. There is an interesting question presented by Mr. Clay's father, and it is susceptible, I think, to a full and complete answer. Mr. Clay states, and states correctly, that it has been the policy of both committees, and it has been the policy of the Supreme Court thus far, and I believe also it is the policy of the courts of England to this moment, not to issue what is known as prior restraints against the press. It would be a mistake for any court to issue an order against the press in broad, sweeping, future terms, and in such terms that he who read it would have to interpret it at his peril. That's not involved here. This is the course of an ongoing trial. This is a case where not the press in the round or in the whole, but two particular reporters, Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Edmondson, who are men, who are individuals, have been handed a copy of an order which said that nobody connected with this case should do certain specific things. And one of those specific things was that no one should comment about the treatment of the prisoner in jail. These gentlemen have that order. These gentlemen, so the proof shows, published a comment on the treatment of the prisoner in jail. Now, I believe it's just a simple exercise of reductio ad absurdum, Your Honor, to say rhetorically that Mr. Clay can't possibly contend that once a person does something offensive to the orders of the court, that the press is justified in compounding and making effective that harm. Now, let me give a ridiculous example, and this is the most ridiculous one that I can think of in the short time that I've had to think about it. But suppose somebody in this case would get up in open court and say, this is a rigged front. Now, strike that in open court. Would say outside of the court that this is a rigged prosecution. I'm going to show that everybody in the Attorney General's office is in the pay of the California wing of the Kennedy Party. That would be a clear, patent violation of the orders of this court. It would be a statement that is calculated to adversely affect any person who hears it. It would be a statement that any prospective juror who read it and believed it would be affected to the detriment of the state to obtain a fair trial. Is it the assertion of my friend Mr. Clay that the press with the impunity could print that and bring it on the breakfast table to every home in Shelby County where every person who is a potential juryman could read it? I cannot believe that that is his contention. If it is, it is absolutely erroneous, and it is contrary to his reading of the Shepherd case. It looks to me it's pretty clear what Shepherd said. The court's subject to regulation, but is highly sensual and worthy of disciplinary measures. Bolton Shepherd. Now, if there's any doubt about that, this state, to the extent that the law is not changed by statute, follows common law. And it has been the common law of England for 300 years, more than 300 years, that statements like this wouldn't be permitted. If this had happened in England, it rises to think what would have happened in a case like this. Now, assume again that I'm wrong about that. Mr. Clay makes only the lightest reference to the corollary proposition. That here was an order of the court, unappealed from, unquestioned in any judicial way. The order physically handed to the people who are not newspapers. Mr. Edmondson is not the commercial appeal. Mr. Hamilton is not the press senator. Given to two citizens. And they don't come in here through Mr. Clay or any other attorney. They don't come in here and say, yeah, we think this order is too restrictive. We want relief from it. They say, well, this order doesn't affect us, and we're going to do what we want about it, or as we think we should do about it. That's exactly what the Supreme Court said in Walker against the City of Birmingham, that you can't do. The rule of law that Alabama followed in this case reflects the belief that in the fair administration of justice, no man can be the judge of his own case, however exalted his station, however righteous his motives, and irrespective of his race, color, politics, or religion. This court cannot hold that the petitioners were constitutionally free to ignore all of the procedures of the law to carry their power to the streets. One may sympathize with the petitioner's impatient commitment to that cause, but respect for judicial process is a small price to pay for the civilizing hand of the law, which alone can give the abiding meaning to constitutional violation of orders which were known, which were understood, and which